Today we're going to discuss more practical aspects of homeschooling. Yesterday we did discuss some of the foundational issues. Today I want to get into more of the practical part of it. I'll be talking today about instilling a love of learning. Now, I want us to understand, though, right at the beginning, that to make these ideas work that I'll be talking about, the foundation of obedience and trust that we were discussing yesterday has to be in place if you really want this to work. Like we discussed yesterday, if the children haven't learned to obey, then they're going to waste their creativity in trying to figure out where the boundaries are. So that foundation of obedience and trust really must be in place. You know, if they haven't learned to submit to us, there are going to be times when a child has to study something that he doesn't feel like studying, or he doesn't even see the value in studying that particular thing. But if that foundation of obedience, submission, trust is in place, he'll understand that even if he doesn't personally see the value of it, that he still has to apply himself and do his best. And another important thing is for us as parents ourselves to be open to truth. We must be open to truth, even if it hurts, even if it cuts across the grain of how we've been used to living, even if it's different from what we've been comfortable with. Our children must see our willingness personally to learn and change our lives. So I'm taking for granted now that this foundation is in place. One of our goals in homeschooling has been to have our children see that learning is fun. And that was one of the concerns which propelled us into homeschooling at the very first, like Ray shared with you last night. Rochelle already knew how to read, so we wanted to be sure that she didn't have to go to school now and slog through the learning to read paces. That would just be a killer. And that was the concern that propelled us into homeschool. A sure way to bore a child and teach them that learning is distasteful medicine would have been to send her to school, have her slog through those things she already knew. That would have just been a killer. Another goal we have is to have our children know how to pursue learning on their own. Of course, when you're teaching them to read, when they're just learning about math, those kinds of things, you know, you just have to spoon feed them. They don't know how to do it on their own. You have to spoon feed them. But our goal is to have them learn how to go on their own and teach themselves, and we become tutors. When Rochelle was teaching a class down in Dallas, she was taking some courses at SIL and also helping to teach a class, and she was teaching students with bachelor's and master's degrees. And in conversation with some of them, you know, they'd say they wish they could study this or that. And she really encouraged them, oh, study it on your own. Study it on your own. And the responses she got from them was very interesting. They had various excuses. Some of them said, well, that's your thing. Or, I just don't have the self-discipline. Or, I don't like to study things on my own. Or some of them said, you know, I need class interaction to help me process the material. Well, they were hampered. They were hindered. And we feel like if that's how it has to be for our children, we have hampered them. So one of our goals is to teach them to know how to pursue learning on their own so that if it's necessary for them to learn something, they can get a book. They can study it and learn it. It's important to remember, too, as mothers, that God is our greatest resource. You know, many times I find that's the last resort I go to, or one that's not used as frequently as I should use it. You know, when we look around, we can just see bountiful examples of God's creativity. Just take one example, maple trees. And yet there are over 100 kinds of maple trees. Do you ever find yourself thinking, well, I'm not a creative person, or how do I make this history lesson interesting, or how am I going to motivate my child in this area? Well, God is the wonderful Creator, and He allows us to tap into His infinite resourcefulness and boundless creativity. So He is there for us. When we need ideas, God's right there. He has them, and He's waiting for us to consult Him about it. We have learned that it's important to begin young if we want to instill a love of learning into our children. Begin young. It's really important to lay a proper foundation so that learning just becomes a way of life in your family. Benjamin S. Bloom said in his book, Stability and Change in Human Characteristics, and I'm quoting now, "Your child has already developed half of his total adult intellectual capacity by the time he is 4 years old, and 80% of it by age 8. I remember when I read that, it just startled me and impressed upon me again the importance of those early years. They are really important. Remember yesterday we talked about Hannah and Jochebed and how they understood how important those early years were and used them wisely. And we need to do that too. If we wait till our children are school age, we've lost valuable time and valuable opportunities that we'll never have again. So begin young to encourage your child's curiosity. You know, our goal, God has blessed us with 9 babies, and our goal was not just somehow to pacify them so that we could pursue our own interests, you know, keep them quiet so that we could do what we really wanted to do. But one of our goals was to help our baby have an interesting time. Boredom is a sure way to squelch curiosity and not encourage it. Well, how do you encourage a baby or a young child's curiosity? You know, it's just simple little things. Have the baby in the room where you are. If you're working out in the kitchen fixing supper, don't have him swinging in the swing in the living room. Have him out in the kitchen where you are. I remember I would put the little one right up on the counter before they were too big to sit up on their own. Have him right up on the counter and talk to him while you're working there. Tell him what you're fixing for supper. Tell them what impressed you in your quiet time. Of course they're not going to understand that, but they love just the interaction of being talked to. They love it. Have conversations with them. Did you ever notice how a little baby, they'll coo and then they'll stop? And you talk to them and then they'll answer. And they'll coo and then they'll stop. And then you say something. I mean, you're having a conversation with them. And you don't know what they're saying. They don't understand you necessarily, but they love it. They're interacting. You're interacting with them. Sing to your little ones. I would actually, when Rochelle was, she was 2, I suppose. And, you know, I found that the hardest time when I had just little ones to get my work done. You know, once you have older ones and you can start delegating, it gets easier. But when you have just little ones and everything's up to you, that's the most challenging time. So I had just little ones, so I would put her just, and what was she going to do? So I would have her sit right beside me on the floor, and she had a little songbook she loved. It was a children's songbook, and it was illustrated with very good art. And so she would sit there, and she would page to the different pages, and I had sung through it enough with her that I knew at least one song on the pages with the pictures. So she'd page it, and I'd sing it, and I'd be fixing supper, and she'd be having a great time. We'd be doing something together, but I was doing my work, and she was paging through the book, and if I started singing the wrong page, the wrong song for the page she was on, she knew it, and she'd tell me that that wasn't the right song, so I'd have to look again and say, oh, okay, and so then I'd sing the song. And we had a great time together doing that. Then once your child can talk, be sure to listen carefully to what he says. And I find that is a real challenge at times because, you know, you're busy and you're trying to, even though you're working at this, you're thinking about other things and how to keep things flowing. And this child can be jabber, 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 and all of a sudden they ask you a question and it's like, oh my, what did he say in the last 3 minutes? So you have to listen carefully. Another thing, answer their why questions. Don't discourage them. You know, they say, why did you drop that, mother? Well, I had too big a load. Well, why did you take too big a load? Well, I was in a hurry. Well, why were you in a hurry? You know, and on it goes. And it's not that they're trying to be an irritation to you. They are curious, and so they ask questions. And actually, sometimes a little child will say, why? Not because he's just that interested in knowing the reason why, but because he loves to hear you talk. So don't squelch that. Also, encourage their curiosity by letting them help you work. Have you noticed how a little child loves to help you? When you're there kneading that bread, that little child likes to be right there, putting his hands right in there, making a big mess, yes. But, I mean, they love it. They love being there helping you. They love to help do the dishes. And, yes, it's much messier than if you just do them. They get wet. You have to change their clothes afterwards, you know. They love to vacuum, and it doesn't get done like you like to have it done. Let them help you dust, and you know what? You're still going to see some dust. And be careful not to go around behind them then and just do it again. You know what that teaches them? Oh, I can't do it good enough. Oh, what's the use? It's no use. Mama just comes along behind me and does it again anyway. You know, let them do it, and if it really needs to be done again, do it when there's no question that they won't see you do it again, you know. So let them help you. You know, when they're little like that, they want to help you work. And you know what happens? Yes, it takes longer. It actually takes more time. And there you are, so busy anyway. You have all these little ones, and here it's going to take even longer. If I just did it myself, I could get it done quicker. Here it's going to take even longer. But you know what? Think long term. Because if you let them help you, down the road, it's going to save you hours of time. Because the day is going to come when they know how to do it. And guess what? You can delegate it. Ah, now they can do it, and that frees you up to do something else. And they know how to do it well, and guess what? They can help teach the next one how to do it. And again, it offloads you. But if you keep saying, I just don't have the time, you know, I have to get this done, I don't have the time, and you just push them aside, or you go play, guess what? The day is going to come when you really need their help, and they are old enough to be a contribution now, and it's like, they're not interested. They don't want to help. You've made your job lots, lots harder. Now you have to try to motivate them. And when the natural motivation was there, that's the time. When they are naturally motivated, capitalize on it. Use it. Don't let that moment slip by. Encourage their curiosity with a wise selection of toys. Don't stifle your child's creativity by too many toys. You know, they love simple things. Have you ever noticed you give a little child a gift, and they'll look at the gift and play with it a little bit, and then what do they start playing with? The box it came in, you know. And the neat thing about simple toys is they use their creativity, and it can be lots of different things. You know, that box can be something to stand on. It can be a platform, and they can preach. Or it can become a hat. Or it can become a drum. Or lots of things, you know. Their creativity, it's just boundless. They can pretend it's lots of different things. So be careful what kinds of toys you give them. Don't give them too many. And don't be frustrated by a baby's game of dropping toys. You know, once our children could sit up, when I worked in the kitchen, I'd put them in the high chair. And I'd give them measuring spoons, measuring cups that nest. You know, they love those kinds of things. But guess what? They would find out that if you pushed that thing over the edge, down it would go. And now the question is, how do you respond to that? Get angry? I don't have time to keep picking up your toys. You know I'm busy. Or is it, do you see that it's really, your baby is learning? He pushes that, gets it too close to the edge one time, and it falls, and it's like, what happened to that? So you pick it back up. Wonder if it's going to happen again. Sure enough, you know, he's learning about gravity. He doesn't know it, but he is. So, you know, if we get angry, we're squelching their creativity. But if we see it as an opportunity to help them learn, it's like, well, sure, it takes extra time to go over there and pick it up. But what kind of foundation do you want to build in your children? So pick it up for them. Let them drop it again. Pick it up again. Let them drop it again. And then the fun thing is that once child number two comes along, child number one can be the picker up. You can explain to him how little baby is learning about gravity. And how if he picks up that toy and puts it back on the tray, and then now watch what the baby's going to do. And he'll see, he's learning. Look how he drops that. So you can even teach your little one how to be a good parent while helping that baby learn about gravity, and that learning is fun. You can encourage your child's curiosity with riddles, brain teasers. Now, a baby, of course, that won't work, but even a young child, our youngest one, loves that kind of thing. And now in school, during the school year, we like to do, Monday morning is usually the day we do a new brain teaser or riddle, and I'll write it on the chalkboard, and they have the week to figure it out. Sometimes they get it done early enough in the week that they beg me to put up another one. I'll just give you a few of them. One we've done is 30 white horses on a red hill. First they champ, then they stamp, then they all stand still. Now that's an easy one that even a little child can do. Or another one, this story. A man at a restaurant ordered some coffee. He drank some of it, then noticed a fly floating in it. He angrily called the waiter over and asked for a new cup. When the waiter brought the refill, he took a sip and then stated, "This is my old cup." How did he know? Another one. This thing all things devours, birds, beasts, trees, flowers, gnaws iron, bites steel, grinds hard stones to meal, slays kings, ruins town, and beats high mountains down. What is it? Let them think about those kinds of things and have the week to think about it. And don't give in and tell them. Don't give in and give them big hints that immediately give it away. You know, help them ask questions that help direct their thoughts in the right way. But don't just give it away. Help them learn how to think. They love it. Another thing we've done to instill a love of learning into our child, I said, is begin young. And we have begun young in teaching reading. I feel like reading is the most important thing I teach my children. If a child knows how to read well, they're set for life to learn things on their own. If they don't know how to read well, they're hampered for life. So I feel like reading is the single most important thing, subject I teach my children. The most important subject I teach my children, and so I like to begin young. I don't like the pressure of, okay, now they're six, now they have to go to school, now they have to learn to read. And you know how it is. Until they learn how to read, they really can't go on their own. They can't become independent learners until they know how to read. And I don't like that pressure of, okay, now this year they have to learn it. Maybe it's a year I was having a baby, or maybe it's a year we were moving and we're building the house, you know, and it's a busy time. So to avoid that pressure, I've started young. Now that wasn't my thought at first with our first one when I started young. It was just that child was interested in it, and so I pursued it. And when I saw all the benefits, I kept it up with the others. But right from birth, you know, a baby loves looking at pretty things. And in our day and age, we have a lot of beautiful books that with beautiful pictures that you can show babies. And as soon as they'll sit still for a little bit, you can start reading them stories. Read to them a lot. If you have older children that can read, let them offload you in that area and read to the younger ones. And then, when our children were about 16, 18 months old, I'd start. And you know, sometimes when you have a lot of little ones, it's easy to just let some of them not have attention. And one thing I liked about starting young like that is that was my time with them to do something special, just me and them. And so I would just sit down on the floor we had these wooden blocks with letters on, you know what I mean? And so I would just sit down on the floor with the baby and build a tower with them and let them crash it. Well, you know, babies love that. And I would just do that maybe for a minute or two several times a day, and maybe some days I was too busy and only did it once a day. But in the course of doing that, I would pick up one of those blocks, and I always started with the letter S, because that was an easy sound for our children to make. And I would just make sure they were looking at it, and I would say, "This is an S." And we'd go on playing. After a while, I'd do it again. "This is an S." Make sure they were looking at it and seeing it, and go on playing. Next day, we'd do the same thing. We'd be playing. I'd build a tower. They'd crash it. I'd pick up that block. "This is an S." After doing that for a little while, one time I would say, "What's this?" And, you know, it's really interesting. Some of the children, after just several, a day or so, could say, "S." Others, it took a whole week before they could say, "S." That didn't matter. It was just a game. Didn't matter if it took 2 weeks. So what? It's a game that we're playing. So after they could say S, then I'd move on to another letter. Maybe B, you know. And so I'd, "What's this?" S. And then in the course of playing, "This is a B," you know. And after they could do those two, then I'd go on to another one until they could say all 26 letters. And it was just a fun game that we were playing. Well, after they could do that, then I varied the game just a little bit. Instead of saying, "This is an S," I would say, "S says S." And so we'd play that for a while, you know. And after they could tell me, I'd say, "What does S say?" If they could say S, then we'd move on to the next sound. And I remember with one of the children, the letter R. I stayed on that letter a long time. Finally, I realized that child just has trouble saying it. So I went on, you know. Didn't bog down with it. Didn't matter if they couldn't say it. I mean, after all, they're less than two, you know, so it doesn't matter. They'll learn how to say it. And then about that time with Rochelle, I had magnetic letters also on the refrigerator to reinforce what we were doing with the blocks. Well, she knew all the letters. She knew all the sounds. And by the way, I only did the most obvious sound. I didn't bog them down with anything but S says S. Because when you say S, you can hear S. I didn't bog them down with, okay, now sometimes at the end of a word, S is going to say Z. So what, you know? All, and it was like with the vowels, I think I can safely say any phonics program I've seen, or most of them, start with the short vowel sounds. Well, what baby? A says ah, you know. I didn't bog them down with that. I said A says A. E says E, you know. I mean, that was the obvious thing. And then, so then after they knew the letters and the most obvious sound that each letter made, like I was saying, we had those magnetic letters on the refrigerator. Rochelle would go over to that, and she would put three letters together, and she was so excited, and she'd say, "Mother, look at my word." And she was so excited, and I thought, good, she's ready to sound out words and learn to read. So I started it with her, and she immediately lost interest. She didn't want to have anything to do with it anymore. Oh, I tell you, I was so discouraged for a while. I thought, I have ruined this child. She was so excited about learning, and here I have ruined that. Well, I had taught school before, and I was a firm believer in the phonetic method, and so that's, you know, what I was going to do. Well, I thought, I have to get her interest back somehow, so I'm just going to try sight words. So I tried sight words. Oh, I mean, her interest was immediately sky high, and she was interested in it. She loved it. And then that was all she needed. She was ready to go. And so that is the method I've used with all our children. Now, I have learned with Rochelle, I made this mistake. She loved learning sight words, so I made flashcards just with anything, any household item, all our names. I mean, she had a thick stack of cards. She knew all those words, but she had trouble reading anything because that vocabulary, I couldn't find anything. The vocabulary was too broad. It wasn't controlled enough. You see what I'm saying? So what I did then with the other children was I got a reading book and I made flashcards of the words in that reading book So that once they learn those, like I think in that first reading book, I used the Dick and Jane series. They would have had maybe 2 dozen words in that first reading book. So once they learn those 2 dozen flashcards, they're actually ready to read the book. And that's really exciting to a little child. And of course, they have to learn all kinds of things. You know, they have to learn. They'll recognize can with lowercase C-A-N, but then they'll see it at the beginning of a sentence. Now, what's that big C doing? You know, sometimes it, especially if you have a letter like L, look. You know, the lowercase L is just one stick. The uppercase L looks a little bit different, so it's like, oh, what's that? But it doesn't take long for you to just say, well, you know, that's still the word look. They'll catch on, and they can read. And so the reason I started with Dick and Jane was because, remember, these children are really little. They want something colorful, not many words on a page, easy to read. And a blessing for me of starting with that series was the story is in the picture. It's in the picture. And so you have to discuss what's going on in the picture. I mean, it's not going to be interesting if you just say, help, help, CC, look at Jane, you know, what's that? But if you talk about what's going on in the picture, say, what did Jane say about that or what happened? You ask them a question, you read the few words at the bottom of the page, it all makes sense, and they love it. And an interesting thing about that series is the children are doing things that a little child like that can relate to. It's the very kinds of things children do. And with Rochelle, I tried lots of different series. And she said to me, she said, these stories are all the same. And you know, I thought about, that's true. The plot was just a little bit different so that they could add on the extra words. That wasn't true in the Dick and Jane series. Each one was very different. You know, it was like a whole new story. It wasn't the same old thing. She loved it. And our other children have too. And they've learned to read with that. And in fact, those books are reprinted by Gordonville. There's an Amish printer in Gordonville, Pennsylvania. And yes, it's called Gordonville, Pennsylvania Print Shop. And you can order the books and they'll send them to you. So that's the approach we've used. Now, the next step, it varied with our children. Sometimes they went through, there are 3 pre-primers and a primer. After our children went through that, some of them, it's like they were tired of Dick and Jane and wanted something else. Others, they actually went through second grade in Dick and Jane before they wanted something else. So it just varies with your child. But that's the wonderful thing about homeschooling. You can tailor it to exactly how they want it, how it's best for them to help them learn to read. And then after they would go through Dick and Jane, then I would go to the library and get I Can Read books or Step Into Reading, easy readers, you know, those easy readers. You can get really nice ones. You can get some that aren't so nice. But, you know, you're the parent. You can choose the nice ones for them and let them read through those I Can Read books. And then another interesting thing happened. Here again, you see the difference in children. One of our children, you know, they'd look at that I Can Read book. That seemed like a lot to read. I said, you don't have to read the whole thing. Just read the first 3 pages. That's all you have to read today, just these first 3 pages. You read those aloud to me, and then we'll stop. That child read first 3 pages, and guess what? They didn't want to stop. They read the whole book. But then we had another child, you know, and it's the same thing. Oh, the whole book. No, you don't have to read the whole book. Just read the first 3 pages, and then we'll stop. Well, that child read the first 3 pages, and they were ready to stop. But guess what? That child loved numbers. They'd go through the whole rest of the book saying every number till they got to the end, you know. So you can tailor it to the individual needs of your children. That's the beautiful thing of it. And then, you know, they learn to read. And it's just, it has been a wonderful experience for us because they know how to read. And guess what? My 2-year-old can entertain the new baby by reading to him. It's wonderful. But more than that, I don't have time to sit with my 2-year-old 3 hours a day and read to them. But guess what? They can read on their own and learn lots. And they can read the Bible themselves. One of our children read through the Bible the first time by the time they were 7. It's a wonderful thing. You know, wonderful. just to be able to read and learn on your own, and they love it. They think it is wonderful because it's not a pressure situation at all. You see, it's not a pressure situation. It's just a fun time together. Begin young, teaching them about art. Expose your children to realistic art. Their drawing is going to reflect the kind of art they look at. So that means have lots of books for them with lots of good art in it. Now, if you would find, go to our house and look at our books, you would find some with poor art. But the bulk of them, I feel, have good art. Now, here's something that I would consider not really good art. This book, Paul Revere's Ride. You can see the art in it isn't that great. Here's another book on Paul Revere's Ride, and it has paintings in it, which are done much, much better. You see the difference? Up there. You see the difference in the two. So you can have lots, you can choose which kind you want. If you have mostly this kind, guess what your children are going to draw like. If you have mostly this kind, guess what they're going to draw like. So have lots of good books, realistic art for them to look at. We don't give our children coloring books. They get enough from grandparents, aunts, uncles. We don't have to give them coloring books. We've encouraged them instead to draw their own pictures and color them. And Ray's a better artist than I am. He used to draw them a quick picture when they were real little. But, you know, it didn't take long before they drew their own pictures and started coloring them. And encourage their efforts with sincere and enthusiastic praise. And especially when, you know, one child might like drawing better than another one. And when our third child came along, it was like he got discouraged. It was like, I can't draw like Rochelle and Renee. And so I explained to Rochelle and Renee what was going on with him, and we made an effort all together, Ray and I and Rochelle and Renee, to especially encourage him in his projects and post his artwork on the refrigerator right alongside the others and make as big an ado about his as the others, even if his doesn't look nearly as nice. I mean, after all, they're younger. And so you wouldn't expect it to look as mature as what an older child's does. And then we've saved samples of their artwork, and we keep them in a file. And the interesting thing about that is it allows them to see the progress they're making. You can pull something out they did a year ago, and, yeah, look, that's quite a change. And they can see the progress they're making. And it also encourages the younger ones when they see, like sometimes our younger ones have been discouraged. We'd say, okay, let's go to the file and pull something out that one of the older ones did when they were little. And they look at that and it's like, oh, yeah, I can do that good or even better. You know, and it encourages them because, you see, a younger one looks at what the older one is doing and how much older is that older one? And they think, well, I can't do that. But if you can pull something out that child, that older child did when they were younger, and it's like, well, yeah, I can do that good. It encourages them to keep on right at the level they're at, because if they keep on at the level they're at, guess what's going to happen? They'll keep improving, they'll get better, and eventually they can work up to that same level that older one is. But if they just stop and don't try, well, no, they're not going to work up to the level of that older one. So it's really helpful to keep samples on hand. Keep that in the file. We've also found it's important to let them develop their own style. I remember when Rochelle was in art class one time. It was during that week Ray was telling you last night when they were taking achievement tests and they stayed for the whole day. Well, the one day they had art class, and Rochelle came home from art class, and she had, it was really a pretty flower she had made, and I complimented her on it, and I mean, she was not at all enthusiastic. I could tell she didn't even like the picture, and I asked her what was wrong. She said, Well, we all had to do it exactly alike, she said. And I thought it would have been nicer if we could have done it thus and thus. And she, you know, for herself, she thought she could have made the flower a lot prettier if she could have done some certain things to it. But no, they all had to do it exactly alike. And it squelched the creativity she had in relation to that. You know, it was like she wasn't enthused about it. So let them develop their own art style and let them try out different things. When we lived in the Washington, D.C. area, we learned to know a man who was the head of the art exhibits in the National Archives. And we thought, well, you know, he was a very excellent artist, and we thought he could give us some advice. What shall we have our children do now? Shall we give them art lessons? They love to draw. Where do we go from here? So we invited him and his family over for a meal one evening, and then we showed him samples of the children's art, and we said, what shall we do? He said, just keep on doing what you are. Don't give them art lessons. He said, that art teacher will impose his style on them. Don't give them art lessons. Just give them lots of opportunity to draw, lots of paper, lots of pencils, crayons, whatever they want. Let them draw. Don't do anything else. So we did that for quite a few years, and then we thought, well, we had moved to another area. We thought, maybe it's time to have art lessons now. So we lived close to that Christian college we were talking about yesterday, and Ray went and talked to the head of the art department there, took samples of the children's art along. She said the very same thing. She said, don't do anything different from what you're doing. Encourage them to draw. Give them the tools to draw. Just let them go with it. And then the interesting thing was, you know, as when they got old enough to go to the library on their own, I remember one time Rochelle wanted to learn how to do a certain technique. I can't even remember what it was. She got a book out of the library, brought it home, worked through it, and she said, that's not my style. Chose not to do it that way. Took it back to the library. So encourage them young to draw and give them the tools. Also, begin young, working with them in relation to Bible memory. You know, that is a wonderful way to be filling a little child's mind right from birth. Start right from birth. That child loves to be talked to, like I said. Recite scripture to them. When they're sitting there on the counter and you're fixing a meal, recite scripture to them. You know verses. We've chosen to recite entire passages to our children. And we usually have started with Psalm 23. That's an easy one, and it's something. So it was a psalm I knew. When I changed their diaper, just that was the time I usually would recite to them because, you know, a baby's diaper needs to be changed many times in a day, particularly a newborn. Just recite that psalm, and they love it. And then you know what? Before that child, when that child is just learning to talk, you can go like this, the Lord is my, and then wait. And that little voice will say, shepherd, I shall not. Just wait, and they'll say, want. And you can go through the entire psalm, and they can fill it in. So you see, even before they can talk, that scripture is going into their minds. I've found that you have to review it, too. You know, once they can do that one, go on to another one. But I found that you have to review it, because it goes in really fast. But if you don't review it, it goes out fast, too. So keep saying that old one, but go on to the new one too. You can put motions to passages. Children love that kind of thing. Put motions to it. Or you can do chorics. You know, have different voices say different things at different times. You can, like if you're learning a psalm, maybe one child can say the one verse and another child the next verse, and then together you say the next verse, and then the mother says maybe the next verse, and then the other child answers in the next verse. It's like a choric, back and forth together. Or you can sing scripture together. An excellent way to learn scripture. Get it into their minds when they're little. Begin young, teaching them music. Listen to excellent music, first of all. Be careful of the kind of music you listen to. Your children are going to copy the kind of music they listen to. Just like they will draw, like the pictures you have let them look at, they will sing according to the kind of music you've been listening to. If you listen to music that isn't quite in tune, that's probably how they'll sing, not quite in tune. If you listen to music that is sung well and in tune, that's going to help them sing right in tune. So be careful what kind of music you listen to. And be sure to sing children's songs with them. That was a mistake we made with our oldest one. Ray and I knew how to sight read, and so for our family devotions, we took the hymn book and we just started page one. We sang page number one, or I don't remember even how many songs we did a night, but you know, we just started at the beginning and went right through. If we didn't know the song, that didn't matter. We just sight read it and sang it. Well, guess what? We thought, why isn't Rochelle learning to sing anything? Well, finally, it dawned on us, well, the poor child, she doesn't hear any song often enough over and over. You know, so we started singing more children's songs. And encourage your children's efforts at their stage. Don't downplay their abilities. I remember we had a family visiting us one night, and they had, I think, about 10 children, and the one daughter loved playing the accordion. And she was excited about it and told us how she has this accordion and loves to play it. And the mother said, well, she can't play too good. And I mean, the mother, as soon as the daughter said how she loved this accordion and loved to play it, the mother was just downplaying it. And I think she thought probably she couldn't play as good as what we would have thought was good. I don't know what she thought, why she was downplaying it. But don't do that. You know, that's a sure way to squelch your child's interest and curiosity. On the other hand, insist that they do what they can do. There was another family. They wanted our daughters to give their daughters piano lessons. Well, then here their oldest daughter, you know, they didn't come. And we thought, well, you know, what happened? So we talked to them. Here this daughter, she said, well, you know, she couldn't play as well as what our daughters could, so she didn't want to come for lessons. Well, Ma, you want lessons from someone who can play better than you. You see, that was the child's pride that needs to be dealt with. And insist that they can do, that they do what you know they can do. To spark your children's interest, get them really interested in a subject and they'll teach themselves. Haven't you found that? If you can just spark their interest, I mean, if they are self-motivated, they teach themselves, don't they? So what can you do to spark their interest so that you can instill this love of learning? Well, one way we found is through books. Have lots of good books available. And I used to, it's like, well, if I can get that book in the library, I'm not going to spend the money for it. But you know what I found happening? There were times when our children, if I had the book on the shelf, and there were just a few moments, they would go get that book off the shelf and read it, whereas if I would have had to go to the library, it didn't get read. Because there are just those times when, well, you know, you have a few moments, you'd like to read something, and if it's there, they'll read it. If it's not, guess what? They won't. So we go to yard sales, used bookstores, thrift stores, get lots of used books. We have lots and lots and lots of books, and most of them we've gotten that way. Book sales, used bookstores, that kind of thing. So have lots and lots of good books available for your children. And I know there's a wide variety on what is a good book and what's not, and that's fine. But some factors we have used to help us determine if a book is good is that it must have a realistic view of life. That doesn't mean it can't have action and excitement, but it has to have a realistic view of life. It should have lots of lessons to be learned, lots of insights into life, and lots of parallels to the real world. The Bible is a good example in choosing literature that's worthwhile. You know, it has stories in it of people doing wicked things, doesn't it? I mean, it has stories in it of people doing murder, assassinations, lying, intrigue, rape, adultery. But it's not explicit with lots of details, and it's never portrayed as wonderful and thrilling, is it? Sin in the Bible is not explicit with lots of details, and it's not portrayed in an appealing and tantalizing way. It illustrates the devastating consequences of sin, and it also illustrates the consequences to the evildoer and to the other people. The villain gets his just desserts in the end, and that's important. There are some books we don't make available to our children. Nancy Drew, Hardy Boy, Mandy books, those adventure kinds of mystery stories, we don't. There are, I guess I'd say the Mandy books are more like the Christianized version of Nancy Drew. There's no way that teenagers can do the things teenagers do in those stories. The plot is unrealistic. The view of life is unrealistic. I mean, life isn't a continuous thrill. In fact, we met a young girl one time whose diet was Nancy Drew and Mandy-type books, and her comment was, "Life is so boring." Well, no wonder. Her diet was those unrealistic books. We don't make Grace Livingston Hill, Geneto Club stories, those kinds available to our children. Those love stories are, they don't portray a realistic view of romance and love. And we don't want our children filling their minds with that kind of thing. Those books don't have lessons, lots of lessons to be learned. They have few insights into life. And I feel like reading those books is similar to watching TV. They both portray an unrealistic fantasy world, and we don't want our children indulging in that. Read books aloud to your children. And Ray told you yesterday how reading The Hiding Place aloud to the children really sparked their interest in World War II and how they hid in World War II and the whole thing of the Nazis, and sparked their interest in writing that novel. Another thing to spark your children's interest is to capitalize on their personal interests. You know how it is. Different children have different interests. Capitalize on that. And that's going to vary according to which child it is and also to how old they are. I remember one of our children was really, really interested in astronomy and in the weather. And so interested in it, got books out from the library about it, that it actually sparked one of the other children's interests in it, who had already studied some of that and found it kind of boring. Didn't really think it was that interesting. And then this other child came along, and it was so interesting to them, and they got interesting books out about it and talked about it, that it interested the other child, and they got interested in it. I remember the time when Roland was really, really interested in learning how to live off of the outdoors. And, you know, that's a boy's thing, isn't it? He really wanted to do that. And so we let him. And my rule was, you can try out things, just clean up after yourself. And so he'd go out, he'd pick, I remember he picked these lambs, you know, lamb's quarter, that what I consider a weed. And he picked, he got those lamb's quarter seeds, and he ground them up, made them into flour, and then he wanted to make pancakes out of them. I said, that's fine, you go right ahead, just clean up when you're done. So he made these lamb's quarter flour pancakes. Well, they were, that was a very interesting experiment, more interesting than good. But he had a lot of fun doing it, and he was learning in the process. So don't be afraid to let your children do that kind of thing. Just teach them how to clean up after themselves, you see. Some mothers, oh, that's going to mess it up, that's going to mess it up. Well, if you're the one that has to walk around behind them and clean it up, sure, that puts a damper on it for you. But teach them how to clean up after themselves and let them go and let them do those kinds of things. Expose your children to stimulating conversation. Make mealtime a valuable time. Don't let it degenerate into worthless talk. That is so easy to let happen, particularly if you have little ones. It can just degenerate quickly and easily. And we've found, in fact, one thing that really helps is if we see that the little ones are just derailing conversations and it degenerates into worthless things, that the younger ones have to raise a finger before they can say something. They'll raise a finger, and when Ray recognizes them, then they can say what they want to say. And the wonderful thing about that is that it makes the younger ones concentrate more on the conversation so that they can have an opportunity to talk. I mean, they want to talk too. So they actually have to listen to what's being said so that they can have something to contribute that's worthwhile. And so when that finger goes up and Ray acknowledges them, then they can talk. Discuss all kinds of issues. You can discuss theological issues. I mean, even with little children. Or you can discuss something special that God has blessed you with that day, or a prayer that God has answered specifically for you that day. Or you can present the dilemmas of your day and ask your children how they would respond. I remember one time Ray came home and he needed to fly from the airport to another city to install some computer software he had written. And when he got out at the airport, and it was a rental car, so he wasn't used to this car, he got out and he heard this ding, ding, ding. It didn't register with him. He wasn't used to a car that did that. And he went back to the trunk to get his briefcase that had the software in it. And then he realized what that ding-ding was all about. He still had his keys in the car, and the car was locked now. And his plane was leaving in a half hour, and he had to get that briefcase out because that's where the software was. What was he going to do? So he asked the children, you know, what should I do? Well, one of them said, get a rock and break the window and get your keys, you know. Well, that's an opportunity to tell them, well, no, that just makes your problem worse. That doesn't help solve it. And so then he told them how he prayed. That was the first thing he did. He prayed and asked God to show him. And so then he walked in and told them at the rental car place what he had done. And they looked, and here they had a spare key. So he could just go out there and unlock the trunk and unlock the door and get the other key. And the problem was solved. So use those kinds of opportunities to teach your children. Expose your children to knowledgeable people. When Ray was working at Goddard Space Flight Center, I remember a man and his wife, John and Julie Hornstein. He was a physicist, and it was fun just to sit and listen to them talk. I mean, they would talk about things I had never heard about before in my life. You know, it was mind-expanding just to hear them talk. And the children found it interesting, too. I remember one time Mr. Hornstein, he was sitting there, and he discussed Einstein's theory of relativity, and he was talking about space and time travel and black holes. And I mean, I'd never heard about black holes before. I didn't know what he was talking about, and the children hadn't either. But some of the children got so interested in black holes that they went to the library and checked out books and learned about what are black holes, what's this man talking about, and they learned about it. And to this day, I mean, just the other day we were having a conversation at the table, and Renee was talking about some things, and, you know, it's like she was one of the ones that heard that conversation, got sparked by it, got some books out of the library, read about it, and learned what this physicist was talking about, and learned from it. And his wife was talking about how she was translating a book from Swedish into English about the effects of too much exposure to microwaves, and how it can break down the body chemistry somehow, and people actually develop allergic reactions when they're around electricity. Oh, I had never heard anything about that in my life. You know, it's like, it's mind-expanding. So expose your children to knowledgeable people. Also, have interaction with people of other cultures. That is very helpful. You can have missionaries in your home, and I think you have missionaries going through here, but also you can be part of a hospitality network, like with New Tribes Mission, Wycliffe. You can tell them where you live, what your name and phone number is, and then if a missionary that works with their organization is traveling through your area and needs a place to stay, they will put you in their directory, and missionary families can call you and see if it suits you to stay with them. So you can call mission agencies and ask to be on their part of their hospitality network. You can host foreigners and foreign students. Now, I don't know if you have universities close by here or not, but if you do, that's an excellent way. You know, the universities close down over Christmas time, and what are those foreign students going to do? And we have friends who use that as a real ministry over Christmas time to always have some foreign students in their home and use it as an opportunity to present the gospel with them. And I remember the one time we were there, and just that past Christmas, they had a young couple there that stayed with them, and they both came to know the Lord in their home that time. And it was just so thrilling. It was wonderful. I remember when we lived in New York City, Ray would go out, and he'd take the children with him doing street evangelism. And he met a Hindu priest in his street evangelism, And they would talk various times. They'd see each other on the street, and Ray invited him to our home. Well, he didn't come the first time we invited him. He had never been in a non-Hindu home for a meal. So, you know, that was a little bit intimidating. But he finally accepted, and then it was like, now what do you fix for a Hindu priest? So, you know, the children and I had the opportunity to do some research and some questioning and finding. We didn't ask him specifically. But, you know, it was like, okay, a Hindu priest will be a vegetarian. Well, how much of a vegetarian will he be? Does that mean just animal products or just meat? You know, which is it? And what kind of menu can we come up with that will be something he'll enjoy that we won't offend him? And so it was a very educational time for us. And we invited him over and had a really wonderful evening together. And he really did enjoy the evening. And it was an opportunity just to let him see a home where Christ lived instead of a home where they had lots and lots of false gods. It's important also to involve your children in educational projects that are fun. You know, we don't do projects in our home just for a project's sake. And you probably had those kind in school. You know, it was like, well, you were studying this certain thing, so you had to do a project. You had to make up something just so you could do a project. And we don't do that kind of thing just to be doing a project. Projects aren't an end in themselves, but a means to an end. If it's more project than learning, then scrap it. But some of the projects we do that I feel are really valuable are sewing. And even our boys like to do simple sewing projects. I mean, I don't teach them how to sew shirts and that kind of thing, but our boys like to go on the sewing machine, you know, and write words with these, you know, embroidered letters, and they think that's a lot of fun. I think it is important for a boy to know how to sew on his own buttons that pop off. That doesn't take long to teach him how, and that really helps with the mending. Even an 8-year-old can sew on his own buttons when they pop off, and that helps offload you. So teach your children how to sew. Teach them how to. Sometimes they'd rather start with just a little doll dress instead. Okay, let them make little doll clothes. That's an easy project. Woodworking projects Ray told you about. And when Roland was 12, he made a train. It was 5 cars, and I just brought the first one. Now, we didn't have woodworking tools. He did it by hand. But first of all, he had to make the blueprint and have Ray's approval. And the first several blueprints, Ray had to show him why it wouldn't work. But he came up with a blueprint finally that Ray said, that will work. Now, he bought the wheels. We bought the wheels for him. But the rest he did all by hand. He did it by hand. We didn't have fancy tools. He did it just with hand tools. He had a lot of fun working on it. He did 5 cars and gave it as a Christmas present to his brothers and sisters. And they were thrilled. They loved it. And he learned a lot in the process. Or Raphael. Our family loves chocolates at Christmas time. Rather than cookies, we do chocolates. So you look at that thing, you say, well, what's that thing? Well, when we're always looking for new ideas. So we were at a chocolate factory, and we saw how they were coating their chocolates, and they would let it nest on there to dip in and let it drip. And it was like, now that would really be neat. How simple. So Raphael, we only had one, and Raphael knew, I really wished I had another one. He made this. He got a square piece of wood by hand. He got this thing all nice and round. Ray helped him show how to get it in there. I mean, how do you get it in there so it's not going to pull out, you know, and helped him get this formed all right. He had a lot of fun doing it. He knew it was something I really wanted, and it was very special to me. So it was a learning experience for him. It was a project that was valuable. Our girls one time every year, give Ray and I a calendar for Christmas. The one year they chose to, for each month, choose a different nationality. So guess what? They had to do research. What will the children in that country dress like? What background can we give that's going to be authentic? And then they chose to write the month and the days of the month in the language of the picture they were illustrating. And so they had to do research, had to look carefully. I mean, I can't even read that, but I know what it's supposed to be. And they had a lot of fun doing it. And then when the numbers were very different, they did the numbers very different. I mean, they learned a lot in doing the research to do something like that. And it was something we enjoyed all year long. And so it was a project that taught them a lot. Of course, Ray told you about the project we had of when they illustrated a book. Maybe your family loves to sing. Record a tape of your family singing. Do projects that have lots of value and that your children enjoy doing. Another thing it's important, too, in making assignments is to make assignments of inherent value. Avoid busy work. That was the concern that thrust us into homeschooling. We didn't want busy work for Rochelle. We didn't want her to have to repeat what she already knew. And because of that, we don't use lots of workbooks in our homeschool. They tend to be a busy work kind of approach, so we avoid that. We avoid a pigeonhole approach of just having lots of facts and not having anything to hang it on. In language arts, you know, it's so easy to have these workbooks that go into lots of detail and tremendous diagramming. So what if my child is an excellent sentence diagrammer but cannot write an interesting composition? I feel like I have failed as his teacher. I don't care if my child can't diagram a sentence. I do care if they can't write and express their thoughts. Which is more important? Really, which is more important? That we can coherently express our thoughts in a written form, or that we can diagram a sentence, or that we can rattle off a definition of an adjective and a noun and a verb and a pronoun and a preposition and all that? Which is more important? So, I mean, and I know that just filling in blanks is not going to teach your child to write. So we choose to focus on having them write, and in the process of writing, guess what? They learn how to use adjectives. They learn how to use verbs that are active instead of passive because it makes a more interesting story and that kind of thing. Of course, again, this is placed on a foundation of obedience and trust. Now, practically, how do you make all this work? Well, first of all, again, we can't neglect our personal walk with the Lord. It is impossible to do this job in our own strength, plain and simple. It's just impossible. And so if you want to feel frustrated, depressed, have lots of days that don't flow properly, just skip your quiet time, and you'll have it. When my heart is overwhelmed, lead me to the what? The rock that is higher than I, the psalmist says. Trust in God at all times, you people. And he tells us, pour out our heart to the Lord, the psalmist tells us again. Also, we have to be committed to make it work. If you're not committed, if we as mothers are not committed to make it work, guess what? It's not going to work. We have to be committed to make it work. I have found that it is important to find a school schedule that works for our family. Find a schedule that works for your family. And sometimes it has taken me a whole month to find my stride for that year. You know, maybe, I mean, my schedule varies from year to year. You know, if it's a year when we had a new baby, that makes a schedule different. And so I remember the one year, it took me a whole month before I found a schedule where things just flowed smoothly and evenly like I wanted it to. And that's okay. You know, don't feel frustrated if the very first day or the first week you haven't found it. Also, don't think you just have to make this work somehow. Be flexible. Change it. Find something that works for your family. Also, in grades 1 to 3, I focus on math and reading. And we don't have science and history. Now, they learn science and history because We read books to them that teach them lots of that kind of stuff. And have you ever looked at a first and second and third grade? First and second grade especially. Science and history book. They are so elementary, you know. By just wisely choosing books from the library, or maybe if you have a big enough library in your own home, you'll teach them a lot more just by reading books to them than what they learn by going through a prescribed curriculum. But in school time, I focus only on math and reading in those grades. And I've found that having schedules saves time. The children know what to expect. They can get into the groove of the schedule and they can go on their own. We have a breakfast schedule, we have a school schedule, we have an afternoon schedule, we have a supper schedule. So I'll just give you an idea of what a day in our house is like. We get up. Now this is during the school year. Of course, summertime, then it shifts a little bit. But during the school year, we get up between 6 and 6:30. Then it's time to dress, comb, children make their beds, have their room in order. And then for breakfast, we have a breakfast schedule. We take turns. And even Raphael and Ryan have a turn. They're 12 and 8, a breakfast turn. And their morning on the schedule right now is Tuesday morning. So they work together on it. Tuesday morning, they get up. And I came down to the kitchen on Tuesday morning, and there they were already. They knew it was their breakfast morning. They get up. They were fixing breakfast. They were making baked oatmeal that morning. And so they were fixing breakfast. That offloads me. It also teaches them valuable things. I want my boys to know their way around my kitchen. You know, if they never get married, they're going to have to know how to fend for themselves. And guess what? If they get married, it is such an encouragement to the wife. If that husband knows how to help her, you know, you're not going to order your husband around and say, now do this and do that. If he can just see what needs to be done and help you, it's such a blessing. So we feel it's important for our boys to know how to help in the house. So they take their turns, and it's important for them to learn that young because guess what? When they get older, then they are doing outside things. And, I mean, our 21-year-old doesn't take a breakfast turn anymore unless he has guests. Unless guests stop in when we're on the road, then he takes a breakfast turn. That's happened. But he knows how to help them. You know, he's not overwhelmed. Well, sure, guests can come over, and sure, he'll know how to fix them a breakfast. And he'll know how to help them out. So we have a breakfast schedule. That means it's scheduled who is going to fix breakfast that morning and also what to fix. We have a breakfast schedule. And it I changed it just this summer. I made out one. For summer, we have a different breakfast schedule than winter because, you know, in summer, we tend to want things that aren't quite so heavy, things that don't use the oven as much. And so I have a 3-week schedule for the summer. And I think, I forget if it's a 5 or a 6 week schedule for the winter, where you just, you know, different things every day. That doesn't mean we only have eggs once in 3 weeks. Like maybe 1 week we'll have scrambled eggs and sausage pinwheels, and the next week maybe we'll have poached eggs, you see, but it's a different kind of egg. So they look, and if it's your breakfast turn, you look at the schedule the day before, so you know if you have to fix anything ahead of time, get something out of the freezer the evening before, they're responsible for that. See, it teaches them responsibility, too. So they know how to go ahead. And then the one that's not fixing breakfast has time to have their quiet time during that time. Then after breakfast, the children all know what their chores are. And those don't change day by day, you know. They know which one's supposed to clear the table, which one is supposed to wash dishes, which one is supposed to sweep the floor, which one changes the towels, which one empties the trash can. In other words, the chores after breakfast are just to basically get the house in order so that we're ready to start school. And then at 8:30, we start school. And we have a bell, we ring the bell. And the children come. And I had trouble sometimes with a child Well, what if they mess around with their dishes or just don't do a chore and it drags on and then it's time for school to start and they're not done? The bell rings. They have to finish the chore, but when that bell rings, the timer starts. For every minute they're late to school, they go to bed 5 minutes early that night. Now, if your children love going to bed, that's not going to work. You have to find something that works. But our children didn't love going to bed ahead of everyone else, all by themselves upstairs. They didn't like that. And our children, like when they go to bed at 8:30, they can read till 9 o'clock. Guess what? If they're late and have to go to bed early, they don't get to read. So that, I have not had to use that very often, and it solves the problem. It's not worth it to them. Their chores are done by the time school starts. And then we start school. And our school day, like I said, starts at 8:30, and then we have a school schedule. And again, that schedule has varied over the years. But I like schedules because it saves me time. I don't have to go searching for things. The children know what's expected of them. We start at 8:30. We start with Bible memory. We review Bible memory, and I have a schedule right here in the front of my book. And so it's right there at my fingertips. Which ones we're going to review each day, we review for, we have 2 weeks worth of review. So, you know, it's like, I know on the first week, the first day, what we review is Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 9 and Proverbs chapter 1 and chapter 2. That's our review for that day. We review that together, and then we work on the new chapter we're working on. Last year, we were memorizing the book of James, and so we'll review that and then work on the new verse. And then after the Bible memory time, we read a proverb together. If it's August the 28th, then we'll read Proverbs 28. Whichever day it is, we read that proverb. And we do that every month. I feel like the Proverbs are just full of such wonderful wisdom. I want my children to have it in their hearts. And we have done it enough years now that what I've started doing is, as I read the proverb, I'll just drop out part of a verse and let them finish it. And so, you know, those proverbs are really just becoming part of them. And we'll discuss ones, verses. And particularly if there's a verse in that proverb and I see a need in our home, we'll discuss it. And then we pray together. And we have a different prayer emphasis every day. And again, I have that schedule right in front of my book. So, you know, it's like, okay, this is Wednesday. Oh, now let me see. Now, what's our prayer emphasis for today? Well, one day we pray about homeschool issues. Another day we pray for suffering Christians and we use Voice of the Martyrs. I'll read an excerpt and we'll pray together. Another day we do You Can Change the World. I don't know if you're familiar with that little book, You Can Change the World. There are two volumes. It talks about children in other nations, very attractively illustrated, and it gives specific prayer requests for the children in that nation, for that country. Makes them aware of world needs. And Thursday, we share personal needs, something that a need we see in our life that we need to pray about together. And the children will show personal needs. I'll share a personal need, and we'll pray together for each other. Or sometimes we do a Thanksgiving time, just a time of thanking the Lord for things. And then on Friday, we usually pray about various world affairs. And that usually takes anywhere from 30 to 40 minutes. And then once we're done with that, we're ready to start our regular school day. The first hour, we do math. And I set the timer. I didn't used to be such a rigid scheduler as far as school time. But what Ray and I realized was happening was the children were wasting time. And they weren't really learning to make good use of their time. And so then in the afternoon, when they should have been done with their work and had free time to do other creative things or time to be doing more things to help me, guess what? There was homework that needed to be done. So we decided we had to become more rigid. in that area. So we did, and that was how we did. We said, okay, 1 hour. You have 1 hour to do math. And if they use their time wisely, they, especially the younger ones, there's no excuse for not being able to get it done. And then the next hour, we would do language arts. And I have a schedule, you know, like on the one, and again, here I have it written, because one, some days we do journal, and then some days I'll listen to them reading orally. One day we do spelling. Some days we do essays, compositions, poetry. So it varies every day, but it's all written out there, and which child is supposed to be reading orally. See, I don't have to think every day now, which one does this? I mean, it's right there, and it makes it easy. And also, if I am not there right at the moment, guess what? No problem. Right there's the schedule. They know exactly what to do. The older ones, I have older ones now, they can just keep the day flowing as if I were right there. And then the next hour, from 11 to 12, one day they do science, the next day history. The next day science, the next day history, and on Fridays geography or health. And then also on Fridays we do art. Friday is more of our day to do things together. Poetry, geography or health, art, all those things we do together. And then when the school day is over, then we're usually done by noon. And then we have lunch. And then the schedule for the afternoon is chores, again, first of all. And I assign those, and that varies from day to day. And I post those on the refrigerator usually. And the children check that. And often the first thing I write down on that is the one whose turn it was to make breakfast perhaps did not have time to have their quiet time. And so that's the first thing I want them to do then, go ahead and have their quiet time so they're sure to have time for that. And then when they're done with that, I want them to do their other chores. And once they're done with their other chores, then they have free time. And then we have a supper schedule too. And so whoever is in charge of supper, that's often the chore they have. And they need to be thinking about what they're fixing and that kind of thing. And I used to have a schedule posted for supper. And when I had little children, that was helpful. Now, I wished I would have done it sooner because it would have been so helpful and it made it easier for me. But you know, to sit down and make a schedule takes time. But I realized after I finally took the time to do it, that really made it easier. It's like, I don't have to. What I found happened, you know, often you're scrambling at the last minute for something quick. Whereas if I had that schedule, you could just look at it the night before. Okay, you get out this, you get out that. And if you have to put something in the crock pot, you can do that in the morning, or you can, you know, your day is under control. It's not a last-minute scramble. Another thing I've done as far as the school day is I don't spend time ahead of time making detailed lesson plans. And I have a friend who did that. I mean, her Saturday was spent all day long making lesson plans for the next week. She burned out, and I'm not surprised. I would, too, if I had to do that. But what I do is, what the children have done, I have this plan book, and I just write it in. Here I write down the Bible memory we reviewed and are working on, you know, so then it's like, oh, now, did we learn verse 20 yesterday or 21? Which one was it we were working on? It's right there. What they did. And then the next day, I ask them, it helps me keep tabs on what they're doing so that they aren't just working on their own and I'm not aware of what's going on. And that's been a real help to me. And that's the extent of my planning. Also, it can be a question, now, what do you do with those little ones while you're schooling? It's really important not to, okay, now you have school-age children, so now your focus turns to these school-age children, and those poor preschoolers are just left to fend for themselves. It's not fair to them, and neither is it as it should be. They need their mother just as much as those schooled ones do. And I have found they love being right there with me. Pick them up on your lap. I mean, after I've had a baby, we've had school all kinds of places, on my bed, on the sofa, you know, just I'll be sitting there on the sofa nursing a baby, and the children will just, the ones I have to listen to will just come around and they'll be there. Or I'll sit maybe at a chair at the dining room table so they can have a table to write on. But just doesn't matter if the child is right there. Or they can have their own box of things that they can do if they're a little older. You know, there does come a time where they aren't just content to sit there, or they aren't content. They want to be doing something. And, you know, the neat thing is often that little one will be wanting to do some kind of school thing too. They see the older ones doing it, they want to do it too. We'll get some kind of simple workbook that they can do right in and let them do it too. They think it's wonderful. Or you can just have a box of things, toys, crayons that they use just during school time. Have their box of school things with the other school things and let that be what they do during school time. After supper then, we have our family devotions, and I said yesterday we just get right up from the table, have family devotions, then do dishes, and the evening is usually a time when the children have just to do what they would like to do. And then for the younger ones, 8:30 they go to bed, and they can read till 9, and lights out at 9. It's really important, though, not to be an inflexible scheduler. That is really important. Don't be an inflexible scheduler. Use schedules as a tool, not as a master. Just use it as a tool. You know, just like, suppose it's a week when you have meetings every night. Well, guess what? Those children get to bed later, and they are not going to be able to get up at normal time and function well in school. So, let them get up later. Just let your schedule start a little later. Let it run over into the afternoon. In fact, when I had only preschoolers, I did not get done by noon. Well, I should say, when I didn't have older ones to help take care of younger ones, I did not get done by noon. You know, I was the only one working with the older ones, and I had only preschoolers. Then I stretched it out throughout the day. And my goal then was to be done by supper time. That gave me time to give a segment to the child that was schooled and still time to be doing things with the younger ones. And then the child could get done with what he needed to do, and even if I needed to do something, then entertain the little ones. So I could do something I needed to do and then do the next thing. And if you focus in those early years on math and reading, you aren't so overwhelmed with all the stuff you have to do. Okay, that's basically what I have to share, and I'll open it now for questions. Okay, the question is, should you let your 10-year-old daughter go ahead and take art lessons? That's a question, you know, you know your daughter, I don't know her. That's a question you'll have to decide. But what we tried to do is provide the tools for our children. And like you said, I mean, I know there are books. In fact, I did bring some along. I forgot to show. Our children liked the Nature Friend magazine for the art in them. But you know what they found? They weren't detailed enough sometimes. They weren't competent enough artists to go from step one to step two. Usually step one to step two wasn't too bad, but from step two to step three, and then from step three to that final one, was very difficult for them. And so I found some books at the bookstore. It's called the Draw 50 series. And there are lots of books. Now you can get some like Draw 50 monsters. I mean, you don't have to buy those Draw 50 ugly things. I mean, there are some that are just, ugh. Don't buy those. But they have some really nice ones like Draw 50 horses. See how simply it starts out. And it takes you very, very simply to the last one. And even our 8-year-old has had a lot of fun with it and learned to do. Right. Here's one, draw 50 flowers, trees, and other plants. And it tells you how to get from step 1 to step 9, or however many he's done. It takes you through the steps. Our boys have liked this one, draw 50 vehicles. And there's one, draw 50 sea creatures, and I can't even remember what all they are. The other one, draw 50 people of the Bible. Our children have, some of them have. Now, these are people, so you can see they're a little more complicated. But it does. See how simply it starts out. And if you have a child...
This art teacher does that. She does step by step so they all follow along so all the kids are kind of... But I guess you could get a book and do the same thing.
The thing that we like about this approach is that a child looks there themselves and does what works for them. Now, I know you can get some video series, the Draw Today series. I don't know. I've never used it. We have a friend that has used it with excellent results. So your question is, should you insist that your 5-year-old learns how to read, sits there and does it, or should you just let him participate with your daughter in the things he thinks are fun? I don't see why you couldn't do both. He doesn't have to sit there for all morning learning how to read. That's going to be a killer. But at the same time, he is 5. He does need to learn that he can sit for a half hour to stretch and do something. And he can learn a lot in that half hour. And the reward is then he gets to sit in with sister and do her stuff. Your question reminded me, in first grade, I do take the children through a phonics program then. You know, by the time they're 4, usually, if they get stuck on a word, you know, it's like, well, what does it start with S? What does S say? You know, they simply do it. But they don't know some simple things that are helpful, like if there's an E at the end, a silent E, it's usually going to be a long A. Just the basic, what I consider the basics. And so I take them through alpha phonics. How do you deal with the state requirement and still have freedom? What I would do is, you know, if in first grade you're required to have history, get those interesting books out of the library, go to those history museums. I mean, we do that anyway. Just, I don't count that part of school.
And that's one of the reasons you start reading early, because you don't have pressure.
Yes, that's right. See, that's a pressure that's avoided for me,
if
I can start early.
Children, if you're teaching from 8 till noon, are you getting into 600 hours? How much of it has to be formal, and how much of it can just be informal?
I'm sure, you know, okay, even with the older children, am I getting in the hours required? With our older children, once they get into the high school subjects, they usually do have some homework to do in the afternoon. They aren't able to get it all done in the morning. And so they do have some afternoon work. You know, once they get done, once we're done with lunch and they do their chores, then before they have free time, they finish what they didn't get done. And so they have more hours in than what we just do together in the morning. I mean, have you ever visited a public school and see what they count as a school day? It gives you a lot of flexibility to count lots of educational things that are truly educational that aren't per se sitting down with a book as something educational.
If you think about the time it takes for a room of 30 children to settle down and get started on that time, you can't even think of that.
That's right.
It's interesting that you use the Dick and Dean series to teach your 2- and 3-year-olds, because I think they are an insult to the intelligence of the 6-year-old who they're designed for.
Right. I agree with that. Those Dick and Jane series, you said, are an insult to the 6-year-olds. And that's why I found...
With her 5-year-old not wanting to learn to read books are too simple.
That could be. Mentally, he's beyond that. Right. So, you know, it's like, well, this is so... It doesn't interest him. Maybe you could find a book. Maybe you could just jump into I Can Read books. Have you tried that? See, once they get really excited about reading, I kind of changed my philosophy, actually. The first thing that wasn't important to me anymore, that they know how to read phonetically. The first thing that was important to me was that they loved reading. And then you can teach them the phonics. Okay, how do you encourage an older child who is not a good reader? Yes, I would say, go back to where they're comfortable. Go back to where they're comfortable and get easy-to-read books that are interesting on that level. And you can get them, you know, like the series Ray was talking about last night, Childhood of Early Americans, that are very, very interestingly written. And so it doesn't seem like an insult to an older child. You know, I mean, I can even pick up a book and read it. It's interesting. And then you have books like Insects Do the Strangest Things, Animals Do the Strangest Thing, Birds Do the Strangest Thing. That's a series. Very interesting, but it's nice big print. But it's not an insult to their intelligence because they really are learning interesting facts. Yes, although I must say that I've had children that read a lot and still their spelling isn't that great. And I have found, amazingly, that just exposing them to spelling more has helped. And what another thing we've done to help a poor speller is I don't use just a spelling series anymore. In fact, I was using Bob Jones spelling. That worked fine. It was wonderful for my children who were naturally good spellers. But for my children that weren't naturally good spellers, it was a waste of time. Yes, they could memorize those lists. Yes, they could get 100% on the tests. And guess what? A month later, they would fail miserably. I thought, well, this is a waste of time.
Yeah, I can give him a list, and he can master the list, and the next week he's writing.
Right.
How do you spell?
Sure.
The word that was on the list, maybe.
Right.
One
thing I've done, well, actually, the first child I had that had trouble with spelling that I feel like I made some headway with was I would just stick with a list till that child mastered it, you know, and then I'd move on. Well, guess what happened? We fell way behind in spelling, but I didn't care. I thought, what's the use of being able to memorize spelling lists perfectly for 6 years just to forget them a month later? That's a waste of time. But then that child was getting old enough, they said, I don't like being so far behind in spelling. And so that child said to me, do you mind if, on my own, I just study my spelling words, and once I know how to spell them, just come to you and have you give me the test? I said, that's fine. So guess what? That child was self-motivated. Every day that spelling book was open, they were studying. And this was just on their own now, not taking time away from school. On their own. Just study those words. Okay, mother, I'm ready for a test. We take a test. And next day, okay, mother, I'm ready for a test. I mean, we did that for weeks till that child called up. And guess what? Suddenly it just seemed like spelling clicked. And I came to the conclusion it was just that intense exposure day after day to how words work that finally clicked for that child. And not that they spell perfectly now, but I mean, there is a 95% improvement, you know. And also then I changed my spelling series. I use now what's considered a vocabulary book. And what's the name? Yes, thank you. Wordly Wise is what I use now. And it doesn't just give them a word and just do a few simple exercises with it. I mean, it has it in context. You work with the definition of it. You work with the meaning of it. You work with synonyms and antonyms of it. You work with, okay, if that word has a Latin root, what are other ways that word is used? It gives them a real exposure to the words. And then not only does it make the spelling stick better, but the meaning of it sticks. And it's been interesting since the children have been using that series. It's amazing how many of these words I see in print now. So that tells you, you know, it's sinking in. And I've seen instead of, 100% on the test, and a month later, a failure. You know, it was like there was only 50% retention, I felt, before, whereas now it's more like 90% retention. Okay, what do you do? It's expensive, you're right. How do you teach a child to paint, to draw? You know, how do you, if you don't know how to do it? It is expensive. And we got these books, and this was the children's birthday presents. You know, they can choose which one they wanted. Another thing you can do is ask knowledgeable people for good resources that would be helpful. And it's nice if you can find a knowledgeable person who doesn't mind giving you some answers to your questions. You know, start trying, particularly try to find from a knowledgeable person a good beginner source and experiment, like he said. You know, you learn some things. And then it's good if you can find someone, I don't know if that person is willing to answer questions or not. You know, if in an art store a person would answer your questions personally or not. That Paint Today that I mentioned on the video series, Draw Today. They actually now have it Draw and Paint. And I've heard excellent reviews of it. And I would like to try it sometime, but we haven't tried it yet. How young do you teach a child to master handwriting? I don't make an issue of that before they're six. It's like, I want them to learn to use that pencil. And, you know, motor skills, those fine motor skills of holding a pencil, that really varies with children. And so I don't care if their W isn't real neat. I don't care if their S looks more like a squiggle than an S. You know, I don't care. And then once they get to be school age, then it's like I do take them through a penmanship book. And
you did mention that you have a child doing compositions that doesn't write them, they dictate them to you.
Oh, that's true. Like I said before, we feel learning to write is very important. Learning how to express your thoughts is very important. And so one thing we do is I will assign a composition assignment. And then they all write on that. And then even the little one likes to write a composition. But if she would actually have to sit there and write it all out, it's too much. And so she'll dictate it to me or one of the other children. And we'll write it down. And then in composition time, when that's read, that one, we usually start with the youngest child, and so she can read hers, and everyone reads their own. And so she gets the opportunity to put her thoughts into words, but she doesn't have to do the physical writing of it. And I don't make an issue of that in the preschool years.
Well, we're planning to put a 3- and a 5-year-old in first grade this year, and I got books for both of them, but I didn't know if that's expecting too much of him to master learning how to form the letters, or if I should try to see if he can do it.
Some children can, some can't. You know, you can see how it goes, and if it's you can tell if it's beyond them, then don't insist on it. Angela.
I was a little confused when you said that you did not make detailed lesson plans.
Mm-hmm.
But that you, what did you do? You did something with?
With my plan book? Okay, I don't make detailed lesson plans. These aren't lesson plans. A lesson plan is you look ahead of time what your child is going to be studying. You decide, you know, how you're going to teach it, what you're going to assign, and all that. I don't do that. What I do is, okay, we're having math today. I say, Rolanda, what lesson are you doing today? What did you get on your math yesterday? I mean, we use Saxon math, and that's one excellent tool to use your child to become an independent learner, Saxon Math. I don't use it in first, second, and third grade. It's terribly expensive, so I use a cheaper one. But once they get to that 5-4 book, which is a hard copy, you can reuse it and reuse it. So, you know, the expense is justified. They read the lesson on their own. I don't read it to them. They read it on their own. If they understand the lesson, they do the problems. If they don't understand the lesson, they read it again. If they just can't get it, then they come to me, and I will go over it with them and help them understand it. And then they do the lesson. And if they still have time in that hour, they check their own lesson. They check their own, and they record their score in the grade book. And then I like them to tell me how many they got wrong, if it was a careless error or if it was an error because they didn't understand what was going on. And then the next day, if they didn't have time to correct the previous lesson, they do that first. And then they go on. And then I write down what they did that day. I say, okay, now what lesson are you working on today? And then, of course, with the little ones, I'll work like with her. She's the one I'm working with right now. She's my one that's not an independent learner. Okay, do I have to make a detailed lesson plan for my little ones? Well, you see, what I did, in essence, was I made up my own curriculum. So with Rochelle, I just tried this and I tried that, and I found out what worked. Then I just used that for my other ones. And so I guess you would say, in essence, I made up a lesson plan in my mind, right with the first one. And so it's up here. So every day I don't have to decide. You know, I know of different things I can do. So I would do the blocks, you know. Well, I didn't need a lesson plan for that. But then maybe they had trouble. You know, they'd know an S and an L, but then maybe sometimes they got a few of them confused. I just made a little bingo game. I'd write the letters they knew so far, and then I'd say, I'll drop this raisin on the M. Okay, so they'd look, and which one was the M? Put the raisin on until they had them all covered. Then I'd say, okay, now you can pick the raisin off of the M and eat it. You know, just make up little games like that. And it's like, if you see a need, you do something about it.
So in a sense, that would become your lesson
plan. Right.
Jotting down your ideas and what you want, you know, idea we're going to try tomorrow.
Right. I would write down what I did that day for them. And so this is just a record of what I did that day. Then the next day, you know, it's like, oh, now what did we do? Now what composition assignment did I give last week? Oh, there it is, you know, and that kind of thing. Okay, what do you do with a child that's slow, not because it's difficult, but just because they dawdle? Well, you find an incentive that works for them. And that's going to vary with your children. You know, what works? What is the incentive that works for them? I had one that dawdled so terribly that I said, if you aren't done in that hour, I'm going to spank you. Guess what? It got done. I knew it could, but I could tell that child was getting into a terrible habit of, he didn't particularly like doing math right then. You know, I mean, what he was studying, he'd rather be doing something that was fun. Well, you know, there does come a time. We want to make learning fun, but there are certain aspects where you can't make every single thing always just super fun. And they have to learn to buckle down, Sarah Ann.
Well, I just found that we don't necessarily always enjoy cleaning in the dirty oven either.
That's right.
So sometimes there's things they have to use.
Yes, I love babies, but do you love changing a messy diaper? I mean, every job, no matter how wonderful, has aspects that, oh, well, they're not the most fun, but you do it anyway because it needs to be done. And a child needs to learn that.
So do you try incentives or punishment?
I like to use incentives if that works. But if it doesn't work, I mean, it was obvious to me that that child was just, it's not worth my while. So it's like, okay, we'll make it worth your while. Okay. The question is, we don't use many workbooks. How do you use...
What do you do instead?
What do you do instead? Okay. And you mentioned Ruth Beechick. Yes, that is our philosophy. I love her books. You know, her You Can Teach Your Child Successfully is an excellent book, and it's our philosophy. And we discourage lots of filling in the blank. I tell you, when we started teaching school, we started with a paced curriculum because, like I said, Rochelle already knew how to read. And that was 20 years ago, and homeschooling is not what it is now. And you didn't have the acceptance in states like you do now. And so we were encouraged to start as a satellite of an existing school because that made it a lot easier legally for us, which we did. But the thing was, we had to use the curriculum they used. And they used a paced curriculum. They used CLE. So we started with that. Well, I tell you, we weren't in that curriculum very long, and Rochelle would go. And she loved reading. She loved it. Oh, Mother, my hand is so tired. You know, I mean, this little six-year-old trying to keep write all these workbooks and stuff. I mean, she literally, she got so tired of it. And we weren't in it long, and we realized she wasn't learning at the level we wanted her to be learning. You know, a lot of fill in the blanks, and she would go, oh, they want this blank filled in. Okay, where's that answer? Oh, right there. Fill it in now. Oh, that's what they want filled in that blank. Where's that answer? She was becoming a master filler in of blanks and was not really learning. So gradually we weaned ourselves off of it. It was nice for me to have a structure to start with. I like that because it can be overwhelming. It's like, what do you choose for all these subjects? I mean, you have to start somewhere. And so we usually encourage families, when you're just starting, choose a curriculum that's basically what you want and go with it. And then try it out, and you can find out what works for your family and what doesn't, and then gradually go to something else that works. Yes, so don't buy 6 years worth of it. Go year by year. And so then the first thing we got rid of was the math. I mean, her achievement test scores showed us that it was weak, that curriculum. I don't know. We haven't used it for 20 years, 18 probably. So I don't know if it still is or not. But we got rid of the math because it was weak and gradually just went to other things. Now, the approach we've used when we do start science and history is to have them read extensively. You know, you can get lots and lots of really, really interesting books on science and history. And children will love it and read. And guess what? They learn lots and lots and lots of things on their own. And I remember the thing that propelled us into that was, of course, our first one. She was our guinea pig. And we had a social studies book written from we were using CLE. So she was really looking forward to the unit on Indians. She was really interested in Indians, and she couldn't wait till she got to that unit in her book. And she read the whole unit, and she said, Mother, I didn't learn a thing. I knew it all already. I thought, this is a waste of time. We're wasting that child's time. What we needed to do was just go to the library, get books. I mean, you can get 3 books really interestingly written that have a lot more information than what you can cram into just, you know, one unit in a textbook. A textbook is limited. It has to be. And so that's what we do. But, you know, it got to the point where once I had enough children that weren't old enough to get out their own books, when I had to get books out for each grade level on science and history, I didn't have enough. I didn't have the time to spend at the library. I mean, I had to take Ray at a day job. I had to work. I had to go while he was at work, when the library was open, and I couldn't stay there several hours. The preschoolers, I mean, that was too long a time for them. And so then I went to a textbook. So I did in science then. I went to a textbook with a Christian publisher. But then in history, still, just to this day, we just get out books from the library or books we have at home. And even with the science yet, I like to get books to add on to what is in the science book. And then once they get to high school, We take them through textbooks to put it all in, like, you know, the history, to have it all fit in, to have the chronology make sense, and to have to fill in gaps if there are any missing. Okay, how do I teach geography with all the children together? Well, we do different things different years. One year we concentrated on learning the states and capitals. Last year we started doing the countries of the world, and we got a geography tape. It has the songs on of all the countries in the world, and the children have loved it. And even our four-year-old can sing the songs, loves it, knows it. And now, you know, she'll go over to the world map and sing the song of the countries of Africa and try to find the individual countries in Africa. So, you know, it really does teach them, and it teaches it fast. And so, yeah, last year what we did was we took it continent by continent according to the song and just studied a little bit about each country. We didn't get done because we only do it on Fridays. And so we'll probably continue now this year.
But how much time would you spend?
Oh, it would vary. But what we started doing, because, you know, they enjoyed doing it, is while they were drawing their art pictures, I would sit there and tell them about the country. And then if I wanted to show them a picture, well, they could look up from their art. And, you know, while they're drawing, they can be listening to something else. And so we kind of combined those two, and that gave us an hour or a half.
What was the name of the tape that you liked?
Do you remember?
I think I sent it
out. Sing Around the World, maybe? Do you want to sing? Why don't you sing the... they do it kind of like the music style of the country, too. The Africa song... is kind of monotonous. It's kind of a chant, you know. That's the longest one. But it was no problem at all. It's fun. They like to listen to it, and they just automatically learn them. And so that's one thing we did. Another thing we've done is we had gotten a game from National Geographic, and we didn't actually play the game, but there were lots of questions with it. And it has an easy question, and then a medium question, and then a harder question. And so I would ask them those questions, and it doesn't take only a knowledge of geography, but often it would take a broader knowledge of putting it all together to get the right answer. And one thing I liked about that game was even if they didn't specifically know the answer, if they would wisely sift through the information they knew, they could often come to a good answer, even if maybe it wasn't the correct one. And so it was a learning experience for them. And they really liked that.
What's the name of the game?
It was just National Geographic
geography
game, I think. I mean, it's comes in a big box with map pieces, and a tetrahedron die. But we didn't bother to play the game because they liked it more if we would just do it that way. So we've done various things like that in the geography time, and the little ones learn right along. You know, in the geography game, they didn't get as many right. But, you know, it was like, well, if it would say, what river runs along through the bottom of the Grand Canyon? We would say, okay, now you remember, we stood up there at the top and we would look way down in, and when Father and Rochelle and Roland walked down to the bottom and they soaked their feet, what was the name of that river, you know, and just help them remember. And just review for them some of the geographical places we'd been. Okay, what's about the use of videos and the internet and the computer? We use the computer as a tool to teach things we can't teach. The children have been taking a French course on the computer. They do that on their own time in the afternoon or evening. Rosalind has been doing a Spanish course. She's interested in Spanish. She was doing Spanish on the computer. Neither of us know it well enough to really teach it. Our children learn typing through a typing program on the computer. We want them to know how to type, but, you know, they're just... excellent programs that they can learn on their own and make it fun to do. And again, they do that on their own in the afternoon or evening. We don't take time out of school to do that. As far as the internet, we do not have our young children using it. For their level, there is ample material in world books. Now, we do have Encarta on the computer, and so sometimes they do research on that, but they don't do research on the internet. Videos, we don't have a video player, so we don't use them. Naturally, simple enough. It's not that we would be opposed to using one if we had one, but... That's right. People can waste a lot of time with videos. You know, they'll think movies are, you can waste time with movies, and that's so true. But people can waste a lot of time with videos, too. Yeah, it's a slow method of learning. You know, I'd much rather, in fact, I don't want our children to become, what should I call them, screen addicts. Because it's a slow method of learning. You can learn a lot faster by reading a book and more detail. And in fact, you know, asks, can I get on the computer? And we basically say, no, you read a book. Okay, can a child read too much? Can it affect them socially? I would say yes, yes. They have to learn to be sociable too. And we've had children like that too. And it's like when you go somewhere, you be sociable. You visit with those people. You interact with them. Because, yes, a child can become just, it can become very selfish, you see. Well, this, I want to read this book and I don't care about that person. Ruby.
You know, I like all these ideas and stuff, but now the question I have, how do you get all your other duties done so you have time to do this?
Okay, how do you get all your other duties done so you have time to do all these things? For one,
you know, like you said, you give chores in the afternoon
right.
to children. Like, how long do those chores last so that they have time to do this special project?
Okay. For one thing, be content with a lesser level of, what should I call it, order in your house when you have only young ones. I have a greater level of order, which is what I prefer now, that I have older ones, than I did when I had just little ones. At the same time, I am not saying just have a messy house. You don't want to teach your children that mess is great. And it's harder to function if you just have a grand mess in your house. But, you know, that house does not have to be dusted every week. Having some cobwebs in the corner isn't going to hinder the functioning of your house one bit, you know. So learn to live with some, you know, that you... I had a mother say to me one time, I just can't get everything done. She had two little ones. I just can't get everything done. So I was asking her some questions, trying to see where she could save time. Well, she dusted three times a week, and I don't know, remember what all the other cleaning, but, you know, she loved her house spotless. You have to learn to give that up. A house is not going to be spotless and have children who are well cared for. You just have to learn to give some of those things up. And then also it's like if you have your children work right alongside with you, it becomes an interesting, fun time together. Because you're working with them, you can discuss things, and it's not like, well, now they're working and now, you know, they're not doing anything creative, they're not doing anything that teaches them anything. And also, if a child uses their time wisely, they can often get their jobs done shorter than if they mess around. And so it's important to teach them to do their jobs quickly and well, and then when they're done, they can have some time off. And there are days when it's just busy. You know, in summertime, there are days, if it's a day when we have lots of corn to do or lots of tomatoes, where guess what? We all work. And we're tired in the evening. But then the next day, they can have time to have off. Now, you don't want it day after day after day after day that they never have time to do anything on their own creatively. And so if you find that that's the way it is in your home, then pray. Discuss it with your husband. Ask the Lord to show you where you need to cut corners so that you have can make more time. Okay, what do you do with people that want to come and spend days with you when you should be using that time homeschooling? Well, I would go ahead and school, you know. And if they are people with children that are such a distraction that you can't, you have to decide where that balance is. You know, it can be done sometimes. Like Ray's parents, they'll come visit us. Now, they are very careful about infringing on school time. And they don't want us to stop just because they're there. And so they like us to just go ahead. But sometimes they're there and, you know, it's just going to be one morning and, you know, it's not a frequent thing. We'll just not have school. But, you know, like you said, if that happens frequently, you can't afford to do that. And so we've found that we just have to let people know that this is school time and it is school time. And just, they can come, but we're going to have school. And so I had problems one time with a neighbor lady who would just, a lonely lady who would call and just, she'd talk by the hour. Well, guess what? When you're schooling, you can't do that. And so what we would do, and Ray had a day job, so he wasn't there to answer the phone and protect me. So I would have one of the children answer the phone, and this lady would say, may I talk to your mother, please? And they would say, well, I'm sorry, she's having homeschool right now, but she'll call you back this afternoon. Or they would say, could you call back this afternoon, which is even better, because then it doesn't add it to me. And if she's busy and doesn't think of calling back, then it's on her, not on me. So it's, could you just call back this afternoon? And that worked very well, that, you know, I don't even like distracting phone calls, and you know, you do all of you homeschool here, so you can understand that, you know, and respect each other's homeschooling times and not interfere with each other. Okay, so what do you do in a schedule when the husband has odd hours that make the children, make you start your day later? Well, that's the wonderful thing about homeschool. Be flexible. And it teaches your children how to deal with that kind of thing. And it is important that they have time with your husband. And they shouldn't be deprived of that. Right. But be flexible and just try different things in your schedule. And, you know, it can work. And I mean, I've read letters from homeschool mothers who the husbands worked at night and then came home in the day, and, you know, they had to be quiet. And I mean, it was a schedule completely different from what I function under. But they functioned well. They were flexible, and they learned how to make it work well for their family. So, you know, seek the Lord. He'll show you. He has wonderful ideas, and he knows exactly how it will work best for each family. Well, my 4-year-old is an asset in helping me. It doesn't take long. It doesn't take long. Very young. Now, it depends on what the job is, of course. Now, our 8-year-old made bread all by himself for the first time last week, and it was delicious bread. The texture was wonderful. So that's a tremendous asset right there. You know, they take their turns, too, our boys, with baking bread, you know. They can, but they'll need more supervision. Like, you know, when that one makes bread, the kitchen is a much bigger mess than when the older ones make bread, you know. And so, and it just depends on what you're talking about. But even so, that one needs more help in school than the 12-year-old, you know. He's not as independent yet. But the thing is, you know, I mean, I would get to the point where I would say to Ray, you know, I am so busy. I just am not getting done the things I need to get done. And then he would say to me, you aren't delegating enough. So I would think, well, what can I be delegating? So I'd think, well, yeah, I could be offloading this and I could be offloading that. And then things flowed again. Then after a while, I'd think, I am just not getting done what I should get done. And I'd say to him, you know, I am not getting done what I need to get done. What should I do? And he'd say, you're not delegating enough. Well, finally I learned when I felt like that, I didn't even have to go to him. I knew what the answer was. I need to start delegating some more. And I found that to be true. You know, it's just need to learn to delegate. Oh, thank you. Where can you find brain teasers? You can find them at the library. Oh, we got, I don't know, 3 or 4 books of really neat brain teasers just at used book sales. So, you know, just keep your eyes open for them. They are all around. They're easy to find. Okay, what method do we use for the children to get up? Yes, they have their own alarm clocks, but I am the alarm clock. They have them so that if they wake up at night, they can look at it. But if they want to get up extra early for something, they'll use their alarm clock. But I usually get up, get dressed, and then I just go around and waken them. And if no, they groggily look at me. Already? Yes, time to get up. So they'll slowly lumber out of bed and get dressed. And some, it's like, okay, time to get up, and up they get.
So they don't get up. Do you consider that disobedience? You know, some sleep.
If I had a problem with it, yes, I would. And sometimes I found out that a child, you know, it was like half an hour later, and I was down in the kitchen, and it was like, where is that child? They aren't even up yet. And I went upstairs, and they didn't even remember being called. So I realized that all depending which ones I waken, I have to have them talk to me and make sure that it is not in their dream, you know, that they are awake enough to understand that it's time to get up. Okay, what would you do with those little ones? Do you let them interrupt, especially for something that requires concentration like learning to read? There are several things you can do. One thing, it's important not to have real long segments of time because that is requiring too much of a little one, of a tiny one. You know, not to let your baby come and because you're going to spend an hour with this child teaching them, that's too long. Another thing they can do is when we are in the schoolroom, then the children need to be quiet. If they're going to talk in there, it has to be quiet. So they're not a distraction. They have to learn not to be a distraction to the others. And that's helpful. If you know your little one can go 15 minutes easily without needing you, then plan that reading lesson so that it can be in 15-minute increments and have a 15-minute slot with that child, and then that baby can be doing something. Make sure you have something for them to do, and they can be doing that. Or if you have an 8-year-old or a 6-year-old that can read well, let them read to the little one for that 15, 20 minutes while you're having your reading lesson with a younger one. And that will be giving oral reading practice to an older one and entertaining the younger one at the same time.